Education and Workforce Development. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 605. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 605 was heard on the last day of January, and it clarifies it was brought by the Construction Contractors Board and clarifies that persons in the business of cleaning or servicing chimneys are required to be licensed as construction contractors with the board, but it would delay any civil penalties for an unlicensed servicing for 1 year. This was an issue of the board and the chimney cleaners thought that they were covered by the statute already, and the AG determined that they were not really covered because they, the principal thing they do is clean the chimneys instead of constructing. So this is a clarification that would bring them into compliance, and most chimney sweeps are licensed with the Construction Contractors Board.
Okay, thank you, Janet.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stark.
Move Senate Bill 605 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Stark moves Senate Bill 605 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Stark, I'll ask you to be the chimney sweep. Open a work session on Senate Bill 465. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 465 was heard on February 7th. It would provide that nothing in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act precludes an employer from establishing or enforcing a policy to maintain a drug-free workforce. It provides that employers are not required to accommodate the use of medical marijuana, regardless of whether it's used in the workplace. It provides that employers are not required to either allow an employee or an independent contractor to possess, consume, or be impaired by the use of marijuana during working hours, or to allow any person who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain in the workplace. Mr. Chair, this bill is at the request of Grant Darrow for Senator, and Senator Nelson was the sponsor. There is no fiscal or revenue impact. There are two additional pieces of written testimony at your place regarding the bill, one from Serena Lee Lane and an email from an individual.
Okay, so we have those two added to our packet. Does everybody have a copy of the additional testimony that was provided? Discussion on Senate Bill 465. Senator George.
I had some constituents come and visit me about this issue and had discussed whether or not the bill could be narrowed down to making sure we're talking about impairment here. And as I understand conversations outside, those discussions happened, and it was difficult to reach any kind of compromise on amendments. And I just was wondering if there's anybody who could kind of put that on the record, that there was an attempt to narrow this bill down.
Yeah. Ms. Trussell, you want to come forward on that? We had talked about a number of issues, and I think it went back to our discussion in committee about the difficulty in determining when usage may have occurred. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries. And as far as narrowing it down, I think part of the discussion was around limiting it to employees who are impaired by the use of medical marijuana. And the problem that employers have is that there's not a readily available and easily affordable method for determining impairment. Most employers are not law enforcement officers. They're not trained in methods that may be available to law enforcement. So basically they have the tools that they use for testing of drugs in the workplace, and that's that's what's available now for employers to use.
So, good, Mr. Chair. So from your perspective in working on this bill in the last couple of weeks, since this has been having a hearing, those issues have been discussed, and we've attempted to try to come to some kind of issue that would limit it, but right now what you're saying is it's just too cost prohibitive to actually come up with some kind of impairment test. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator George, what I'm saying is that the conversations were just, that I've been involved in, were just the testimony that was at the hearing.
Okay.
But I've verified with our friends from Serenity Lane that things hadn't changed since the last time that I had asked the question about, is there a tool readily available for employers that's affordable, and the answer still remains no.
One last comment, if I could. As this bill, And I guess I guess in looking at going forward with this bill, I guess I'll be okay with the bill. But if you could just be sensitive to the folks who are advocates for medical marijuana, and if we can find some way to take into account some of their concerns, I would really appreciate it as the bill goes through the process and gets over the House. Because it seems like to me that if we could come up with a test that was effective, I would be considerably more comfortable without limiting people's rights.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I understand that, and that would be something I'd be happy to talk with my members about. But again, it gets down to what's available for employers to use and what's readily and what's affordable, readily available and affordable. The other thing is that at AOI, and this didn't come up in the testimony previously, but we during the interim, when we were working with a large group of people on different workplace drug issues, one of the things that people talked about was maybe looking at how you get a medical marijuana card. And our group determined that was really beyond our interest, because our interest is what's at the workplace. And so that's why when the bill was presented, we presented it as you know, what is a, you know, if it's in the workplace or if it shows up in our tests, as opposed to taking a look at the entire statute and maybe making recommendations on how a card is given or the kind of tracking. Like with most medications, even if you're taking it continually, you have to go back periodically for get your prescription extended and things like that. So we opted just to address it in the workplace and not to go into how you get a card to begin with. And that was because we did recognize that there are people that rely on that.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have questions from or discussion by the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Well, that's Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Starr.
Yeah, was one of a very strong proponent of medical marijuana, just because of my experience, particularly with cancer patients. And so there's no way that I want to hold the patient who is in need of medical marijuana from having it. But I also am just actually quite surprised, maybe not quite appalled, that there are now 19,000 people with medical marijuana cards, and maybe that there is a medical reason. But the people that I had worked with would not be in a workplace, and those are the people that I want to protect. And I know that this bill will help businesses for sure, and yet those who truly need it will also have it. So that's why I'll be in favor of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 465 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 465 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I appreciate the comments from Senator Montes Anderson and Senator George. In most cases, I align myself with those comments. I, too, have had folks visit with me about this issue and the issue of doing different tests, having businesses do different tests. And I looked into that. Folks that came and visited me, I committed that I would, and I have. And I'm just not convinced that they're really conducive to an employer workplace. I think that they are. There's a significant expense involved. And, you know, maybe down the road there will be better tools available to employers. But at this point, I believe that this bill is the appropriate thing to do to promote safety in the workplace.
Anybody else have a comment? Senator Deckard.
Just one, Mr. Chair, and I think Lisa was getting at it. To me, and I talked to some of the employers just recently, it's about an hour and a half ago, the real issue, and this bill doesn't get at it, is who and what about Oregon's medical marijuana law has allowed 19,000 people to get it, rather than what in other states would be 500, 600, 700, 800, maybe 1,000. And the real intention, and maybe it's just such a dicey issue because it deals with an initiative that citizens have passed and so many other issues, is I believe this bill came about as a second action that was actually more easily accomplished at the legislative level, because it just gets at the clear, and I agree with employers on this, that you have to have some standard practice which says that if we are a drug-free workplace, we know without any hesitation that the courts upheld our ability to enforce the drug-free workplace that we've put into place. And so for me, in some ways, this is a second, it is the course of easiest application is how we got at this, because it would have been much harder to go at the real issue, which really is, I believe, what about our initiative allowed folks to access the medical marijuana card that actually are not, for whatever reason, the initiative didn't intend for them. That's my comment.
Thank you, Senator. Well, and then just to close, I think that those are very valid points, and there are a number of other pieces of legislation that are going to be heard in this legislature some shortly regarding some of those other types of issues, and I think that will be a very enlightening discussion. I think, but as Senator Montes Anderson pointed out, and my view is to be able to differentiate between those issues and the issue before us today, and that is, should an employer have a right to regulate in their own private workplace, a drug-free workplace, and do they have a right to do that? Certainly an individual with a medical marijuana card has a right to choose to apply to work there or work somewhere else if they don't want to work in that condition. But I think it's also very, very important for clarity for those employers, and especially since there is some issue with conformity with federal law, that clarity be given them, and then everybody goes in with their eyes wide open as to whether they want to work for that employer, and the employer, whatever their rules are, want to enforce that for everyone or just part of their population. So with that, would you please call the roll?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Becker?
Aye.
Senator Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Votes aye.
Chair Metzger?
Votes aye. Senate Bill 465, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed, and the chair will carry on the floor. Thank you, members. Is Senator Walker here? Yes.
We have a bit of a conflict on about the.
Okay. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 415. While we're waiting for Senator Walker,
418.
Or excuse me, 418, thank you very much. We're going to have a brief presentation on the public purpose charge. So if people from PUC want to provide that, can come forward and get ready while Janet explains the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 418, at the request of Senator Walker, would allow the Public Utility Commission to raise the public purpose charges on large private utility customers above the current 3%, and large means more than one average megawatt load, above the current percent if the total charges collected by utility are maintained at 3%. The bill also eliminates the 1% public purpose charge for aluminum companies. There are currently no aluminum companies operating to be charged the public purpose charge at the current time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And just before we get started, I think Senator Walker will point this out when she gets in. Apparently, the bill, there is a drafting error in the bill, which makes a significant alteration as to what it actually does. And she's aware of that, and we'll bring that up when she comes today to testify. But I think we'll begin with the presentation of what the public purpose charge is in the first place. Chairman Beyer, welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chair. I'm just thought I had this all set. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have with me Dr. Lise Farling, who is the Director of our Utility Programs. Our purpose today is to support Senator Walker's Senate Bill 418. We think it's a good first step, although it is in need of an amendment. And I'm going to shut up and let the senator speak because she just walked in.
Well, you know, just in time, senators. What's what we're all about here. Senator Walker, if you want to come up and join. Chairman Beyer, go ahead and stay there. Senator, we are just now starting.
Oh, good.
And I initiated the discussion by saying, by the way, that there was some drafting errors in the bill. as presented, and that those would be explained so that we're on the right page as we move forward. So I think we'll just start with you, because Chairman Beyer had not yet started the presentation of what the public purpose charge is. So if you want to go ahead and start the discussion, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And I brought Dave Hendricks with me from Legislative Council because I was hoping the amendments would have been ready, but they're still in publication. And so I thought, well, I'll bring the drafter with me. He didn't draft the original bill. Dexter Johnson did, and Dexter's no longer.
So we can blame him.
Yeah. So we can blame Dexter for any drafting error. And, well, there was some misunderstanding about what I was trying to do in the bill, which basically, Mr. Chair, is to make sure that the industrial customers can have their public purpose charge increased as well as residential customers. Currently, the PUC has that authority, though I have also drafted Senate Bill 87 as an amendment to my bill. I think the PUC has Senate Bill 87 in another committee, and I thought, you know, I'm pretty efficient. I like things all done at once in one place. So I have that as a -2 amendment, but we'll talk about that later. But that does give the PUC, I believe the PUC has authority to raise this public purpose charge now, but there are some who do not believe they do. So that's what Senate Bill 87 does, and that's what my -2 would do. As you know, currently only, even if the PUC does believe it has authority, it cannot raise the public purpose charge on industrial customers, and I don't think that's fair. And why don't I think that's fair? Because I believe everyone should be paying into this fund that we're talking about here. And Mr. Chair, I went through, here are all the notes, the hearing notes from Senate Bill 1149 that I had my staff download from the 1999 session, and I recall this bill very well. The Senate actually didn't work all that hard on the bill because the House made a bunch of the amendments, and they did most of the work on the public purpose charge, and I've got all my little sticky notes here where they talk about it. And, in fact, at one point, Representative Witt said he thinks the Senate decided to punt on the issue, and then he let Senator Gerfler know he would be bringing the issue to the House committee. So they punted, and the House did what they thought was right, but I don't think they quite got it right. So that's why I'm here today making that change. I had attempted to decipher in the record all that was said about it, but last night, well, it was this morning, about 3 a.m. when I was working on this, I realized that when my staff had downloaded the notes, they cut off the right-hand margin of all the paragraphs. So it was really, really hard for me to understand what someone was saying in the entirety. So we reprinted it, and I'm still looking at some of the material. And there was some concern. Representative Bob Montgomery was concerned that his mother's rates would go up, as well as business rates, and that we would be paying for someone else. I thought that was kind of funny. But the public purpose charge has done a great thing for Oregon, and I do want to have Mr. Hendricks speak to what the amendments are that are being drafted, because there are problems with the bill, and if I hand those to him, he could probably do that more intelligently.
Here's Mr. Hendricks, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. Dave Hendricks, Legislative Counsel's Office. Dexter does not take any of the blame on this. I drafted this. Senator thinks he did, but I didn't. There's blame here on this.
Yeah. We're not assigning any.
An almost incomprehensible piece of legislation. And consequently, it's one of those bills, I think, that unless you happen to be in the room at the time it was drafted, your odds of understanding it are not very good. Two things that we did in the original bill, Senate Bill 418, that I've now advised Senator Walker probably are not significant and do not need to be done, is the pieces relating to aluminum plants. From what the PUC has now told me, there are no aluminum plants out there operating at this time or paying the public purpose charge. I now know that the reason why these provisions were in there would provide a mechanism to buy electricity, to get the public purpose charge from aluminum plants who were buying their electricity directly from the Bonneville Power Administration, and consequently there was no electric company who was selling them electricity to collect it. So this was some sort of mechanism to try to make sure they paid. And since at this point we have none, It seems to me that we can leave it in there for what it's worth. If there is one at some point, there will be a mechanism. They set a kind of arbitrary amount for how they were going to collect it. It was going to be 1% of the total revenue from the sale of electricity to it, whatever. It's not significant, so the amendments in the Dash 1 amendments will restore that language, and will also not amend the provision in 757-687, which was the public purpose charge language for consumer-owned utilities. None of the consumer-owned utilities, to my understanding, has gone to direct access. Consequently, none of them are collecting a public purpose charge anyway. The whole provision relating to the public purpose charge for consumer-owned utilities was contingent on them going, making the election to go there. They haven't made the election. So it will be for another day to look back at that if they decide to go that route. Right now, it doesn't look like there's much of a press out there among the consumer owns to go to direct access. Yeah. So what we do, what we will do, and hopefully those amendments will be here shortly. They're working to get them out as quickly as possible. What the amendments will do is take a look at the language that currently appears in Senate Bill 418 from lines 13 through 17, which sets basically the amount of the public purpose charge. Right now, the language in that particular provision is a little strange in that it begins out by talking in the first sentence of subsection 2 about electric companies basically collecting the charge from the consumers, which is the way we all think about it, is that they tack it onto the bill, and that's correct. On the other hand, the amount of the charge is equal to 3% of the total revenues collected by the electric company or an ESS, an electricity service supplier, from its retail electricity consumers. Now, the logical way to do that would be to just tack 3% on, and I believe that's pretty much what they've done. The problem here with the large consumers is that, A, we have this one provision that limits how much you can collect from them, and the fear was if you just took that away, that you might still be subject to the 3%. You might mean you have to shift. If you raised higher then, would you collect less from other consumers? You know, how would it work? And so the amendment we came up try to makes it clear that the PUC can set a totally separate public purpose charge for individual consumers or classes of consumers, and particular one could be a different percentage than the 3% that's currently specified. So you could move them entirely out of that 3% computation and say these customers are going to pay this much, and it would be entirely up to the PUC to set that rate. So that's the Dash 1. The Dash 2, as Senator Walker's already indicated, is essentially Senate Bill 87, which has a lot more detail with respect to the rate setting by the PUC for the public purpose charge. Okay. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. I'd be very happy to give you a copy of these amendments as soon as I get them into my hands.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. You know, I think everybody but our two colleagues to the left were involved with 1149 in 99, and Chairman Beyer, my colleague in the Senate at the time, was the leader on that issue, and I don't think I've ever seen a piece of legislation that was so hard fought that turned it out doing absolutely nothing except for this public purpose charge in the last 8 years almost. So there were some elements of it, but certainly it was a time in which the market was changing dramatically, as you recall, and with electricity prices and everything else. And we thought, well, I probably still did the right thing, but the market certainly did not cooperate with us. If that's it, Senator Walker, any more before we go to Chairman Beyer?
I think that's it, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it. And I'll just sit back and listen to the commissioner while I finish reviewing the record. It's really fascinating to review the record. Senator Deckert is proudly featured in there as well. He was on the House side, and I was there, and
Senator Starr was there on the House side. And I hope it doesn't escape your attention, Mr. Chair, that this bill is Senate Bill 418. And our contentious bill last session was Senate Bill 408. So I just have this thing for fours and eights, and I just wanted to let you know that this is likely to be contentious, but hopefully it has as good of an outcome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Beyer.
I'll go ahead and see if I can get those amendments to you as quick as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Start once again. Well, I sure hope the senator is wrong on this one being a remake or redux of 408. That certainly wasn't an issue. But it is I am appreciative of the fact the senator pointed out that all of those public purpose changes happened in the House. And I'll tell you, as the carrier in the Senate of 1149, I found there's a lot of things in that bill that I really wasn't that familiar with.
And now infinitely familiar, right?
Very much. I've often said I'm doing penance. But I can't miss the opportunity, Mr. Chair, just to point out that there has been a lot of good that has come out of that bill. Many people who are advocates of restructuring the electrical industry nationally believe that Oregon did it right by splitting off the residential from the industrial. And unlike many of the other states, we haven't had the problems that they have had. We probably certainly haven't had the changes that I think many of us expected would happen. But we do have a number of large industrial customers that have chosen to go directly to the market and have seen it to their benefit. And we do believe that there is some effect in terms of dampening rate increases by having it in place there. So I think there are some positives that did come out of that. But to this bill, as I started to say before, we are in support of the senator's bill. As she mentioned, it eliminates the 3% cap on the level of public purpose charges for large industrial customers. And for your information, that applies to approximately 250 companies in Oregon. So it's a fairly large number, and they're predominantly, in fact, I think they're exclusively manufacturers. And that's in both PGE's and Pacific Coast territory. But the reason we're supportive is that our recent studies have shown that there are many more opportunities for cost-effective conservation or energy efficiencies, whatever term you choose to use here, through this, and we're just not getting the maximum benefit that we could. When we proposed Senate Bill 87, primarily it was to change the collection charge and to let us get more into there. There are a couple of other things in our bill that are not in the senator's bill, although it sounds like they'll be there in her amendments. One of those is to be very specific that any additional revenue, if there is any, would go exclusively to energy conservation and renewables. The other one has other things in it, bill payment assistance and some of those. I know Senator Deckard has some interest in that area, and there's other legislation that will address that this time. But we're trying to get right at the bottom line of what will help customers. The senator got a little bit into the discussion of what we've kind of referred to as the size of the pie versus the size of the slices of the pie issue. And you'll hear from people who were involved in that, and again, people have different perspectives of what was in 1149, saying that the commission already has the authority to increase the 3% except on large customers. I can see how they can read that in the bill, but I will tell you that the Oregon Attorney General disagrees. The Attorney General has told us that we could change the size of the pieces of the pie, but we can't increase the 3% overall as it would apply. So it would be one customer versus another. And currently, all customers that are subject to the 3% pay the same. So it's equality across the board. And conversely, to the extent that we're dampening down the increase for new generation, all benefit equally in that matter. So that's the issue. Some of the arguments, now I can tell you, we heard this the other day in another Senate committee on our bill, Senate Bill 87. And some of the things you'll hear is that the 3% charge was part of a deal, and a deal's a deal, and it shouldn't be changed. And I certainly appreciate that, although I would point out that you know, deals have a lifetime, and this deal is almost 10 years old, and certainly the circumstances have changed dramatically since the time when we enacted that bill. Rates have gone through the ceiling. All of us are well aware of what happened in 2001, 2002. Many of us are well aware of what happened to natural gas prices over the last 3 or 4 years. Everything's going up, nothing's going down, and the driver on that is, you know, we have growing load, as I'll show you in a minute, and the question is, how do you meet that? So things are different, and I think there's always a time when you revisit a deal that was made and say, what's appropriate public policy now, not what was appropriate 10 years ago. The other thing you'll hear is that, and this is certainly true, our large industrial customers are facing global competition, and to the extent that the public purpose charges increase, that will cause them additional problems. Well, all costs are going up. That's certainly true, but I would argue the other side of that discussion and say that to the extent that we invest well in the public purpose charge, and these customers all have something, the large customers, that others don't. They can direct invest their own money. They can take over 80% of the money and invest it in conservation or efficiency projects in their own companies and get that done internally, which would reduce their energy costs. They also have the advantage of, once they've used up all of their money, they can, under current policies, go to the Energy Trust and have 50% of additional cost above what they can self-direct covered through the Energy Trust program. They also have the advantage of energy tax credits, which the legislatures have made available, and low-cost financing to get these things done that you've made available. So there's a lot of tools that you've given them to reduce their energy expenditures, and those are something, once they do that, go on for a long time. Plus, collectively, they benefit, as does every ratepayer, when we reduce the demand for new electricity and it keeps rates down. So I think that's some of the arguments. So, Mr. Chair, if I can, I just want to very quickly walk you through a PowerPoint that gives you some background on this. And with your permission, I'll try not to screw it up.
Okay.
First off, I wanted to just give you a sense of what's happening in terms of demand. I'm going to give you two looks at this. This first one is from the Northwest Power Council, and it speaks to what we can, or what they expect will happen in the region in terms of demand. And you'll note that the red is the band of possible outcomes that they foresee. The good news is that there is some variability. The bad news is that they're all going up. Load is going to go up unless we do something about it. This drops it down into Oregon and looks at specifically PG and Pacific Core. And same alternative here. You'll note that the trend is for more load growth. And it makes sense. Population is growing. This is more in the numbers. Get away from the graphs. And it shows you by the year below how much we're looking to add into the generation base or the load base for that. So what do you do about that? Load's growing. How do you address that? There are only three things that you can do. You can make market purchases as a utility to get the generation to supply your customers. You can build new generation or new resources, or you can conserve. That's the only three things you can do. Well, if you're looking at the market, the darker line, if you're looking at here, is the actual monthly purchase price on energy over since 2004 through 2006. The purple line was the forecast, and as you'll note, they all go up. The piece to understand about that is it varies by season, obviously. The market's going to be highest when there's the highest demand and lowest. But the point is that if you compare it to where we were in 2000, 2005, which we were bouncing around $30 a megawatt hour, these are all up and higher. Costs are going up at the market. Looking at the generation side then, if you don't buy at the market and you want to buy at the generation, a couple of things. What we did is, one of the goals that we have established for the public purpose charge is to try within the window of the 10 years to create a savings of at least 300 megawatts. So we compared it to what does a 300 megawatt generator look like. A coal generator, and this is the average looking at what's going on, it's going to cost you about $485 million to build one. A gas generator, a little bit less than that. But the variable on that is coal is more expensive, but the fuel stock is cheaper. Gas is cheaper capital-wise, but the fuel stock, and you'll notice on the gas lines, the purple line, you see where they're going. Gas went from when I first was on the commission about $1 to $2 a unit, went up as high as $15 during the, I believe it was 2004, and is settling now in about $7 to $8. So it's just up, and that's the effect of global competition. Other discussions that you're going to have around here are the other alternatives if you didn't want to do fossil fuels or renewables. And you can see here the same comparison there. Wind is a little more expensive, as is solar, is a lot more expensive. But again, the advantage of these is once they're in place, you don't have a fuel cost. So then the option then is, what do you do? Conservation is there. The advantage of conservation is once you invest in it, you don't have future risk involved. You don't have, as with coal, you've got a CO2 risk. Carbon risk, there's a lot of discussions in D.C. now about that. Currently, there is no carbon constraints. If you looked at much of the rest of the world, Europe, for example, they have a carbon tax and a cap-and-trade program. If you add $10, $20, $30, as in Europe, per ton to that, it increases your cost a lot. So you have a risk associated with that. You have both a price risk of the fuel stock and you have a environmental risk. So we looked at the potential of what we could buy through the money that's currently available versus what we could buy, you know, if there was more money available. And we looked at what's cost-effective, being under 5 cents a kilowatt hour on a levelized basis. And essentially we've seen that with a little more money we could get, one, we can't get to the goal we'd like to with the money that's available, and very cost-effectively, cost-effective being cheaper than additional generation, we could get up to another 150 megawatts or about the size of a power plant of conservation. And there's just a comparison of what it looks like on a levelized cost. The middle column gives you what's the cost of coal, gas versus conservation. Our current conservation numbers are coming in at about a penny and a half a kilowatt hour, so fairly cheap. This is the history, very quickly, of how we used to do conservation before we created the public purpose charge and the energy trust. Prior to 1149, all utilities were required to do conservation within their rates. So you didn't, customers didn't see it, but it was there. And as you can see by the orange lines, you know, it kind of varied a lot. We didn't have a consistent program, and that's one of the things that we got with the when we created the Energy Trust through the public purpose charge. Some people have wondered whether we have a cost-effective program or not, so I just thought I would show you what others are saying. Quote that's up there from Vermont and from Wisconsin, both are very, very supportive. I will tell you that in the energy business outside of our state, Oregon's Energy Trust is held up as a model of the way to do it, and they're thought of as being very effective. Again, this is just another one. Talks about this chart here shows you, if you look at the purple chart, is what other utilities in the region, how much it's costing them to get conservation versus the red, which is the energy trust. So we're saving a considerable amount through the trust operation. And again, this is just an example in the power plan that the Northwest Power Council put out. They set a target for all of the utilities in terms of making it. And you'll notice that the trust, which represents Pacific Orange and PGE, are doing better than anybody. These are just a couple of extra quotes. I'm not going to go through them, from PGE and Bonneville Power. They're saying that they think that they have a good relationship and are doing well. So this is just very quickly what we've been able to achieve through our public purpose charge to date. We've powered over 95,000 homes through the savings, and you can see the listing there, the various ways we've been able to achieve some conservation. And again, this is just the difference. I'm running very fast through this, I know, but I don't want to waste your time. There's the red line is what additional we could get with our proposal, which was $7.87, and a little more money, and the purple is the other side. So I think, Mr. Chair, that was very quick through there, but I think the lesson or the takeaways that I think you should take away from that is, one, we are going to have increased demand in Oregon for additional electricity. That's just a fact of life. We can solve that to some degree, significantly, very cost-effectively through conservation. or we can solve it through putting new power plants in charge. Either way, either result is going to come back in terms of the customer's rates. The question is, do you want to do it the cheapest way? What's the business way to do it versus some other way, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Chair, that's my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer. Just one question, then I'll ask the committee for questions. Regarding the public purpose charge, which puts a collection mode for these utilities for this purpose, how does that play in, if at all, in your rate-making process because of the fact that this is a burden they must carry? Does that play as a cost or an expenditure in any of the rate-making cases, or is it totally independent of all other factors?
Mr. Chair, the public purpose charge is a required charge that's separate from the rates. The rates will be what the rates are going to be based on the cost of the individual utilities' operations. So it's separate from that. But obviously, there's a reflection there to the extent that you save some money by not having more generation. It helps keep rates down.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for the chairman. Senator George.
I hope I don't have to declare a conflict of interest since they helped pay for part of my washer and dryer. But nonetheless, I understand the purpose, and I obviously think it's a great achievable purpose. But, Mr. Chair, I guess my question is that with the increasing cost of energy and this being a percentage, I guess I'm not understanding why there isn't a built-in increase. If you're getting 3% of more money, it seems like we already have a built-in sort of inflation adjuster in there, and I'm not sure why we're coming back and actually asking for more money on top of that. So if you could explain, we have to be getting a lot more money into the public purpose charge than we ever projected because energy costs are so much more. If I'm mistaken on that, I'd like to get that corrected.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you are correct. There is an escalating or inflationary effect to that. But I would encourage you not to focus on that point. The question that I have in my, or the way I would look at it, and I would hope you would, is what's the cheapest way for us as consumers to meet our energy needs? Because we're going to, if that load goes up, we're going to pay for that one way or another. The effect on the ratepayer is going to be similar. One of the advantages of doing it through efficiency gathering is, one, you can, load doesn't grow in 300 megawatt lumps. But unfortunately, power plants are built in 200 or 300 megawatt lumps. And that's the technical term in the industry is it's lumpy. If you can get it at a little bit at a time, you can avoid those larger cost investments. And still, the focus is how do you do it the cheapest, not whether it's going up or not. The reality is that the public purpose charge as we have it today does not allow us to capture all the cost-effective conservation or efficiency measures that's out there. So we're losing those and replacing them with more expensive generation costs. That's the trade-off that's there.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my follow-up question that would be then is it seems like to me that you have a sort of a law of diminishing returns. You have a law of diminishing returns calculation to do here. And I guess what we would need from you is that if you have this increased amount coming in because rates are going up, at some point, more money coming into the public purpose charge is not going to return back what we're getting early on in that public purpose charge. And so I'm trying to guess, in my mind, 3% seems like an immense amount of percentage, and then you have this growing rate. At what point would you be satisfied that we've raised enough money in that energy in the energy trust to actually get the efficiencies you're talking about? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's you're right on target with that. The way we look at it is we have what we call least cost planning, and we would look at it in that context, which is very simple as the words sound. We look at what's the cheapest way to meet it. At some point where the additional efficiency measures are more expensive than the generation, you would stop doing it. But so far, there's more out there. There's more effective things to do. You don't just spend, from my perspective, from ratepayers' advocates, we're not going to spend money senselessly. You only spend it if it's the cheapest way to meet the need.
Looks like your ears were burning. comment you'd like to make?
Dr. Sparling wants to get into the game.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Lee Sparling. I'm director of the utility program at the PUC. I just wanted to add a little bit to Senator George's first question about the additional money that comes in because the rates have gone up. The reason rates have gone up is because the costs of generating resources, existing and new generating resources, has gone up. When that happens, and that is reflected in rates, the other thing that happens is that there is more in the way of conservation that is cost effective. We move a little farther up what we call the conservation supply curve, that because you may now be displacing a generating resource that costs 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour, there is more conservation than there used to be that is cost effective, and we ought to be pursuing that before we invest in those more expensive generating resources. Senator Metzger, if I may, one clarification for the committee on something that I think Chairman Beyer mentioned with regard to low-income bill payment assistance. I raise this because low-income bill payment assistance is the subject of another bill that is in front of the Senate. I'm not sure which committee. It may even be this one.
Right here.
Senate Bill 461. Low-income bill payment assistance is not part of the public purpose charge. It was established through Senate Bill 1149, but it's a different piece of the statute. So this discussion on Senate Bill 418 and our Senate Bill 87 doesn't have anything to do with low-income bill payment assistance. That's all over in Senate Bill 461, I believe it is.
If I could, one last question.
Yes, go ahead.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the kind of the flip side to your discussion there was as rates go up, it's got to be easier to get industries, residential folks, and everybody. I mean, I know I switched to fluorescent bulbs in all my entire house once the rates went up, so that there is also a corresponding incentive on the private side outside of the energy trust. And I guess what I'm concerned about here is that this is looks to me like this could be a significant increase in the change, and it seems like we already have an increase, and then we have a built-in incentive to the private sector to invest also, and I'm trying to figure out what the crisis is that this is necessary. It seems like we have a good program going in the right direction framed the way it is, and I guess I'm having a hard time figuring out. You have double incentive now because rates are higher. You guys have more money, and the private sector has a desire to invest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I'm not sure I'd call it a crisis. I'd call it more of, as I sit and look at the plans, utility plans, I'm staring at plans to build some fairly expensive generators. And there's justification. If we don't do more, you know, if we can't cut the load, cut the peak particularly, those generators are going to go online, they're going to go on rates, and rates are going to go up. So it's, I don't see it as a crisis. I just see it simply as a business decision. What's the best way to meet the resource need?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Decker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, that was it's very helpful for me to see the first two slides, the crux of the decision in terms of here where the energy needs are going to be, and here are our choices, conservation or new generation. The concern I have is, and perhaps you are the czar for the state on these issues.
I hope not.
If czar is the right term. I'm now sticking with it now that I...
Ingpen.
Ingpen. The concern I have is just, so you've got the RPS, and that's, I'm just thinking of all the bills out there that are in play in this legislative session. You have one that, like this bill, that's in a different committee. You have this bill. You have the bill paying assistance, which I think is a great idea. But that's also, here. You have two or three large incentive programs that I'm aware of on the tax side. And so, I guess the concern I have is that it would be nice to look at these collectively rather than, and I'm sure you might share this, rather than in four or five different venues, and perhaps it's just welcome to the legislature that you get this, but to me it would be very nice to see this collectively and the state make rational decisions about where are we going to do RPS and are we going to do something along this line that gives you greater flexibility to invest in conservation over generation, rather than what I guess the fear would be is that we are going to pass a number of good ideas and then collectively look at the PUC and say, oh my gosh, look at the rates we're paying now because we did this, we did a very good idea on bill paying assistance, which is very minimal compared to that. very minimal. It is, and for commercial, even less minimal. But that we collectively have done a number of programs, and at the end of the day said, well, why didn't we look at these in concert? And, wow, we have. So perhaps that is the PUC's mission, is to try to shepherd from the House to the Senate and really look at all the ideas in play and try to get a better, what I think perhaps might be a better decision-making than just kind of throwing out good ideas across and seeing if, what the governor signs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, I can't say that I disagree with you. My role now in life, having been on the legislature, is you set the policy. We try to find a way to implement it in the most efficient, cost-effective way for Oregonians.
Well, then maybe, Mr. Chair, somehow we need to ask the bill to stop going to five different. There's one focal point, at least in the state Senate, where we evaluate rates, what we're trying to do, and how we get there.
Thank you, Senator Decker. Your point is very valid, and one of the reasons that we're having this hearing today, because we have had hearings in some of the others, is exactly for that purpose, to kind of start putting stuff in the dustpan here and kind of evaluating globally before we decide, you know, how they might interact or counter each other, and what relating clauses we have to take things out of other committees and make it into one nice little package, as you have suggested. So, seriously, you're absolutely right. And I think part of that is getting the issues out on the table so we could see which ones, if any, are ones that we think we want to pursue. And even though they have similarities, as the chairman pointed out, there's a lot of differences as well. And so, any other questions of this panel? Senator Mona Sanderson.
I know that a small percentage of this goes to low-income housing construction, and according to the background here. But we haven't talked about where this money goes. And I was just wondering how much. I know we're just talking about conservation, but it also states that this goes to renewable energy resources, low-income weatherization, and a small percentage for low-income housing construction. Is it a significant amount? Do you know how much?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Monis Anderson, even if you look at the bill, Senate Bill 1149, it's a little hard to figure out what the percentages are, because the percentages were laid out for most of the public purposes, then the low-income housing was layered on top, and you take 10% for that, and then those other percentages apply. So for affordable housing, I believe it's 10%, and then you have to ratchet down all the other percentages in the bill. For the purposes that the Public Utility Commission handles, which are the ones for new conservation as well as renewable resources, that total amount is about 74% of the collections. Another piece goes to schools. I don't recall the percentage off the top of my head, but we can certainly get that for you.
No, it's in the bill.
Again, you need to multiply those percentages in the bill by 0.9 to reflect the fact that 10% is taken off the top for the low-income housing.
Okay. I guess follow up. I guess what I wanted to, so if we remove the cap, the 3% cap, is this bringing more money into the system so that then these various percentages, the weatherization, that will get incrementally increased amount of money also?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, the 418, as it was presented to you, does not address that issue. It would, but I think the Senator Walker said that she was bringing in Senate Bill 87. For those percentages in the original legislation just kind of spew down, as Dr. Sparling said. The bill that we proposed, Senate Bill 87, which I think one of these amendments might put into this, mm-hmm. would have taken any additional money over the 3% and dedicated exclusively to energy efficiency or conservation and renewables. So that was a change that we made.
Thank you.
Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, how much do ratepayers pay total? to the Energy Trust? What's the 3%? What's the total amount that is raised? Do you have any idea?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, the projection for 2007 is that the overall public purpose charge will collect about $67 million. Of that, about $50 million, just under that, will go to the Energy Trust. The numbers are a little imprecise because industrial customers have the opportunity to self-direct some of their funds, and that can affect the collections in any particular time period. But those numbers are about right.
That's an annual figure?
Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, do we have, as legislators, how does that money spend? I mean, does the Energy Trust, they're independent, not regulated? Do they come to the legislature for authority to spend those dollars?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, they do not. That money does not come into the state treasury. That money is a payment directly from the utilities to the Energy Trust under a contract between the PUC and the Energy Trust. It's a performance contract. We've set specific goals for achievement of that, and that's the way it works.
And there's one other question, Mr. Chair. It relates to your slides number 7 and number 9, where you list the cost of a 300-megawatt coal, gas, wind, and solar. Those are numbers that you got from the Northwest Power Planning, Northwest Power Conservation Council, I guess. That doesn't represent actual projects, but those are just for display demonstration purposes. Is that correct? We don't have a 300-megawatt solar plan that's out there that somebody's building.
Do we have a 300?
Not solar.
Not solar. I'm saying we do on wind.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. The question that I have is, Lee, is do we have an idea of what it would cost to build a 300-megawatt nuclear power facility?
Well, one, I don't think you could build a 300. They seem to come in about 1,000 megawatt chunks. And the last one is measured about, I think, $2 billion.
I'm not sure.
I'm trying to recall, Senator, a number that I just seen. There are 10 of them that are under permitting, mostly in the Southwest and Midwest now. And I thought I seen one that was above that.
For 1,000 megawatts, a couple billion dollars.
And that might be. I'm not sure of what that is, but I think that's in the ballpark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Moss Anderson, we're going to move on to our next group of panelists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're always focusing on the investor-owned public utilities, and I know that's a huge issue here in the state. And I've always... can you give me any, maybe even the politics, et cetera, why we aren't looking also at making this an equity issue on all... utilities.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Mona Sanderson, the policy of the state has been that you provide for local control of consumer-owned electrical utilities if the citizens or ratepayers of those areas so choose, and they have. And so you have local control. They get to decide what they want to do there. With very few changes. For the most part, almost all of the consumer-owned, and there are a couple of exceptions, the Eugene Water and Electric Board being the biggest, they are pretty much what's called full entitlement customers of Bonneville Power Administration. So those utilities mostly run the local distribution, but the transmission, the generation, and all that is pretty much handled for them by Bonneville, and they fortunately get the benefit of Bonneville's dams when the IOUs don't.
Can I answer your question?
Well, I'm just seeing, I think that statewide conservation should be a concern for all utilities. It would benefit everyone, but you're saying those that are mainly with Bonneville wouldn't reap the benefits.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't want to mislead you. I think many of those consumer-owned, if not all, in fact, all of them have some conservation programs in place. Some of them are quite extraordinary. Eugene Water and Electric Board, for example, has a very aggressive program, as does Emerald People's Utility District. And I'm sure others of them do, too. I just happen to be more familiar with those two because they're where I live.
they do it in their own way, and that's the nature of local control, you know.
Mm-hmm. Are there some, just on this one part, are there some utilities then that maybe don't, aren't quite as conscientious as...
I wouldn't want to go there, Senator.
So you're saying, to me that says yes, there are some who are very conscientious and others that aren't. All right.
Well, he didn't exactly say that.
No, he didn't say that.
Yeah, no. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, so to no one's surprise, there's another point of view. And so John Charles, Michael Early, and Julie Brandis have all signed up in opposition. So let's get the opposition up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, representing Cascade Policy Institute, a market-oriented research center in Portland. And I'm probably one of the few people, I guess, in the state of Oregon who was not part of the Senate Bill 1149 varsity that was negotiating all this. I just missed it, I guess. And but maybe that's an advantage because I don't come to this subject sort of bound by a certain worldview and a deal. I'm just looking at it as what makes sense for policy and especially what makes sense for ratepayers. And I'm trying to understand, frankly, not only the rationale for the bill, but the rationale for the entire public purpose charge. As a ratepayer, I just feel like I'm a cash cow. I send my money to somebody, and these rational people at the state somehow they're all knowing, and they know how to spend my money better than I do. And I think that entire approach needs to be reexamined. I think the line of questioning that Senator Montes Anderson had just a minute ago is as one of many questions that I think that should be asked about this. And this is supposed to sunset in 2012, although, of course, now there's a move to sunset it in 2022. I think sunsetting would be an excellent idea. But to the bill... First of all, if you want to subsidize, or if Mr. Beyer and others want to have more money to subsidize renewable power, and I'm a supporter of renewable power, well, lots of people, most ratepayers in the state, can already do that voluntarily through their green pricing programs. Oregon is a leader. PGE is certainly probably the leader in the country. But notwithstanding that, roughly probably 97% of all people who have that opportunity in Oregon voluntarily decline. They are not interested in paying substantially more for wind or solar investments. In some areas, EWEB, I think it's less than 2%. Down in Ashland, I think it's less than 1% of people who have the choice choose to do so. They decide they have better things to do with their money. So if that's the case, where's the political mandate to force this on them through the public purpose charge? Second, if energy conservation is cost effective, then I think people who buy the types of appliances that Senator George was talking about or other investments that you can make, such as weatherization, if it's worth doing and you're going to save money, then you should do it on your own dime. Go borrow some money. Make those. I don't see why I should be forced to pay for things and then assume that the Energy Trust knows more and can pork barrel that money to benefit me. I think many of the claims of energy conservation need to be examined much more seriously. A lot of claims are made about capturing cost-effective energy. There's these buzz phrases in that field. I've been hearing them for decades. I think if you really want to go there and just hand over some more money, I think all of those claims need to be validated. Probably the only legitimate reason, from my view, to tack on a surcharge would be to help low-income folks pay their charges, but they're already getting that help from completing another the $10 million charge outside of the public purpose charge. So I guess I would just kind of point out in conclusion that the reminder that wealth is created through the constant reallocation of money from relatively low-valued activities to higher-valued activities. When you intervene through this and you take money and then you go build things, such as windmills, that as standalone investments are not cost-effective, well, then you're not creating wealth. You're destroying wealth. And since it takes energy investments to create wealth, you're also wasting energy. So I think this whole approach needs to be really examined aggressively before you sort of hand over a blank check. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Let's go ahead and Ms. Brandis.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries, evidently part of the original varsity team. So it's been a long
go
time.
Go team, go.
It's been a long time since I've been able to say that, and that was cross country, and it's a long time ago. So let me go. I've handed this piece out to you, and I've had the opportunity to sit down and walk through this piece with many of you. This is an outline we did for the AOI Board of Directors to explain to them some of the background about the trust, as well as on the back explain the position that the AOI Energy Committee adopted in terms of, pardon me, public purpose charge, and what the committee adopted in terms of the public purpose charge that was both supported by AOI's Executive Committee and AOI's Board. I think my exploding pie chart might be wrong, and that would be on the first page, the green and pink and purple. And I think that's based on what I just heard from Dr. Sparling, but I'll check that out. But in general, you can get a good concept of where the money goes for the energy trust. And I think it's important when we looked at the original legislation, when we walked around and we lobbied it, we actually thought, and it was a mistake on our part, but we thought that only the legislature could increase the 3%. And actually, the commission can increase the 3% for commercial and residential customers, but not for industrial. And that was inadvertent on our part. But we do think having that cap there and making it that the commission has to increase it for the that the legislature has to approve the increase for the industrial serves as a good check and balance. It would be very difficult politically, I think, for the commission to increase the 3% for small retailer and then not do that for example, a national retailer who has a big store that has over a megawatt of usage. In terms of politics, we view the 3% like a tax. It's a tax we support. However, the tax was created by the legislature, and the business customers believe that there has to be some accountability in terms of this tax. And the trust, the Energy Trust of Oregon, is accountable to the PUC, and the PUC is appointed by the governor, not by customers. The trust has a self-appointing board, and there's no legislative balance. And you saw the commission put up some quotes about what a great job the trust is doing. We have been supporters of the trust. We have worked with the trust. That does not mean that we haven't had some serious concerns about how they operate. And we have posted those publicly on our website, and we have worked with the trust. But keep in mind, with the self-appointing board and with the commission in charge of them, we don't know where the oversight would come from if we were concerned about if a large problem did come up. Senator Walker did talk about how good for Oregon this has been, and like I said, we are generally fairly supportive of the trust. But keep in mind, this is a private utility customer-funded program. And I think Senator Mona Sanderson did a good job of pointing out that public utilities, most of them do have some type of conservation programs. I don't know enough about all of them. But that money is locally collected, it is locally governed, and by locally elected boards. And that's a significant difference from the trust. I think Senator Deckard brought up a very good point, too, in terms of the types of legislation that are floating around the session. And we are actually going to start creating like a thermometer to measure the amount of legislation that is in play that increases energy rates through legislative mandates. And I appreciate the commissioner in terms of, you know, wanting to put more conservation projects in the ground because that would reduce the need for energy. But keep in mind, one of the mandates you'll be looking at this session is an RPS mandate. And I have not seen a single RPS mandate or outline of an RPS bill that includes conservation. So no matter what, the PUC is going to be forced with very difficult decisions about investment, and all of them are going to have to come in terms of, not all of them, but I would suggest most of them will probably have to come in terms of renewable power. So it's not that you're balancing necessarily conservation versus coal. It's the mandate's very clear that we have seen about mandating more renewable power. So those are some outlines of our concerns. I just want to make sure that you also know that the public purpose charge has increased due to rate cases. And in 2002, when the trust started collecting, they collected 40, pardon me, the public purpose charge started collecting at $40 million in 2002. You heard from Dr. Sparling that this year it's predicted that the public purpose charge will collect about $67 million. It's about a 60% increase. There's no need to move additional authority over to the commission to do that. Keep in mind the trust, where most of this money goes, is a very young organization. We are still watching its growth. We are still watching how a locally, a self-appointing board operates. And so that is why when we signed on to the original legislation with groups from CUB to Osberg to AOI to ICNU, we all signed off on the date that 2011 would be the best date to revisit this, because we'd have data to look at, to, and then we could make a decision whether we supported an increase or not at that time.
Thank you, Ms. Brandes. And cleanup on this panel. Ms. Gurley, welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Metzger, Senators. My name is Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. I have members who operate manufacturing facilities in the state of Oregon. They all are have electric loads in excess of one average megawatt. I'd like to talk first about the nature of the legislation itself. Previously, you heard there was a deal struck amongst the various components that came together for Section 1149, and I think the language itself indicates that there's more than just a deal that was ad hoc put together at that time. There's a legislative expression that there was a linkage between certain items that are together in that bill, and I think we heard testimony today that reinforces that. For example, the bill itself starts out by saying that beginning on the date the electric utility company offers direct access, at that time and only at that time does the public purpose charge become applicable. And so is that linkage between direct access program and the public purpose charge. And we see that the amendment initially would apply also to the publicly owned consumer-owned utilities, and apparently that's going to be withdrawn because retail access hasn't happened. So I think there's that linkage between the public purpose charge and direct access. And are we really cherry-picking amongst a variety of issues that were reasonably addressed together? Secondly, I think there's a linkage between between the public purpose charge percentage and the size of the load. I think clearly the commission has the authority, at least in our view, to increase the percentage applicable to smaller customers. We think the legislature, reflecting the linkage between the size of a customer's load and the public purpose charge, capped that at 3% for large customers. I think that's reinforced by the aluminum company piece, which is in the bill. That the aluminum company loads, there were only two in Oregon, one at the Dalles, one at Troutdale. Troutdale was in the range of 300 megawatts, far and away the largest in-use customer in Oregon at the time. And yet we see there the limitation for those largest end-use customers was 1%. So I think we see that the thought that was given into this program, that for smaller customers, 3% of a relatively small electric bill is a small number. But for larger customers, such as my members, let's cap it at 3%. For really large customers, let's cap it at 1%. So I think there's that linkage that needs to be carried forward and continues to be a factor of concern in how this is whether it's changed or not. So our basic position is we think the public purpose charge as it exists today with the 3% cap applicable to customers over one average megawatts is appropriate. We think there's no reason to modify it at this time. If it is eliminated, it essentially gives the commission unfettered discretion, if you will. There's no cap at all. The statute doesn't provide any particular evidentiary standard or showing that the commission would have to provide to raise that. And as previously noted, it doesn't have to be uniform. There could be very distinct differences between what the percentage is applicable to large customers as opposed to small customers. So in that sort of a context, we feel we need the comfort of a cap, certainly as it applies to customers such as my members, for whom electricity is a very significant portion of their overall production costs. Secondly, the bill as structured, the 3% is increased to 4%. It doesn't all go to conservation. It just increases the total, which is allocated out as it is allocated out today. So it's an increase for renewables and for all the other purposes as well. Finally, as already indicated, there's already a built-in increase, if you will, in the way the measure is set up, because it's tied to as a percentage of utility revenue. So clearly, automatically, there's an increase that's been made in the amount of funding available for conservation, and that is likely going to continue. Finally, we have concerns about, frankly, how the money is spent, and I'd like to just read briefly from the Energy Trust's strategic plan. This is a document dated November 8th of 2006, and it's forward-looking. They have the commission has established a conservation target of 200 megawatts over the 10-year period, and there is a stretch target of 300 megawatts. And what the trust has said here is that the current mix of programs is expected to fall 50 to 60 average megawatts short of the 300 megawatt target, but they do expect to meet the minimum 200 megawatt target set forth by the commission. So what this says is, you know, we are adequately funding the trust to meet the standard that was established by the legislation and the commission. Really, what we're talking about is going beyond that and meeting the stretch goal. But the important point is that the trust goes on and says the energy trust analysis, their own analysis, suggests that the only way to significantly increase electric energy savings is to close down some programs and redirect the funds into the commercial and industrial sector. And my point is that there seems to be an acknowledgement that we have adequate funding to meet not only the minimum goal, but the stretch goal. We just need to spend the money in the right way. And so with that, I'd like to just conclude and thank you for your time.
Shirley, thank you. One thing I would ask is that, since you were reading from a document from the Energy Trust, would ask if we could, at the end of the hearing, have that made available to Janet so that she could make copies for everybody on the entire document for everybody on the committee. Questions of these panelists? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the whole conversation of oversight really caught my attention. And since this is, can you, any of the witnesses for the most part, envision a way that we could draft legislation that would, in these amendments, that would give the legislature more direct oversight, similar to what we have for other. Can that work within this confines of what we're talking about here? Could the legislature actually be the ones that this group answers to? Because it seems like to me that's a big concern. I know I got free light bulbs one time from the Energy Trust, and I appreciated it, but I wasn't sure it was all that smart of a delivery, because I would have bought them anyway. But I just was wondering why there hasn't been a proposal to make this trust more accountable to the legislature or to elected officials.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, historically, when the funding element was started, and I'm thinking back and trying to put this all together, I think what happened was there wasn't a complete decision within the legislation about how the money would flow and where it would flow to. And the commission was given the ultimate authority, and they established the trust, and they appointed the first board of directors without much consultation with the primary customer groups. At least AOI wasn't consulted, and I know at the time ICNU was not consulted about who to put on that initial board. So that being in mind, when we drafted the original legislation, we didn't put those checks and balances within the Senate Bill 1149. So that being said, I'm sure something could be drafted. Is it something that the AOI Energy Committee and the AOI Board of Directors and Executive Committee put any thought into it to this point? No, but it's certainly something we could probably do long term. I don't know if you want to add to that.
No, that's Senator George, if I might, I actually doubt there is anything you could do. I thought about this a lot in the context of transit districts. TriMet in Portland gets about $170 million a year of payroll tax money. So if their members were elected instead of appointed by the governor, would it make any difference? No. Once they have the money, game's over.
Good one last final question. All of you sort of had different ways to approach this general issue. It was some of you more aggressively and others more gingerly. If I could, is the net result of what we're getting? What we've heard from the commission is that we're getting big bang for our buck, and I haven't got that we've got the same kind of excitement from the industry groups that we're actually seeing effective use of these dollars. But to me, it seems like as soon as the costs go up, I know we change things in my processing plant very quickly when costs go up, and I'm trying to figure out where the balance is here, and if maybe John, if you could maybe delve into a little bit more about more of the free market approach of how you could see we could use these, and maybe the industry could do the same thing about how we get industry to do it more of an incentive-based program than maybe a subsidy-based program. There could be a discussion on that. I really appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I do believe that most people are rational decision makers. I operate my life the same as you talk about. When prices rise, it catches my attention. I change what I do. It has its own intrinsic reward. So I think the problem, what we need is more markets, not more pork barrel. And I think we're going down this path that makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to really untangle whether something is a bridge to nowhere or a bridge to somewhere. And that's why I think you'd have to be really careful before you put more money into this.
My members are highly motivated to reduce their energy usage. It is a significant cost. And all of them have significant budgets, shareholder money, with which to evaluate their facilities and implement those programs. What the trust money does is it doesn't provide financial incentives for all of the many programs we do within our fence that pencil out themselves. What the trust is funding is solely providing that additional money which is necessary for the program to pencil out, to go forward. And so in most cases, we're only getting a small, in many cases, the programs we do, we don't qualify for trust money. We're going to do them anyway because they make sense. And in those cases in which we do qualify for trust money, it's not paying for the entire conservation cost. It's paying for just a small increment of that. So you know, when you think about, well, we're paying this 3% for conservation, I mean, really, we're paying a lot more. We're paying the 3% plus what we're spending voluntarily for conservation. So you know, from our point, we're doing our share and doing more. And I think again, the 3% cap recognizes that industries, particularly large industries, are going to spend the time to scrutinize their processes and make those decisions in a more timely fashion and more aggressively than smaller customers.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Deckard.
Mr. Chair, if I could throw just two out there, one for this side of the table, or John, and the second one is for Julie or Mr. Early. I haven't met you, so I'll call you I'll call you Michael. So
first name basis, all right. See how fast that was?
So, John, I guess the first question, and this is terrifically interesting to me, is how, if not government at some level, whether it be local or state, or obviously federal is the best venue because then it is one and done, but how do you incent, because I'm thinking just rational actor model, price goes up, your PG example is a good example, and people opt for the short-term, more expensive energy over what perhaps might be in their long-term interest, which is to develop more renewable options. And I'm trying to think, how would, like low-income energy, where there's just going to be no market incentive, how would the markets effectively push customers, be they large customers or residential customers, to what is in their rational long-term interest, which would be, I think, undoubtedly more usage of renewable energy and less usage of non-renewable energy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, that is a fascinating question, and I should say, by the way, that I don't I don't think that we are all rational actors, utility maximizers, as they say. Lots of us, probably most of us, are irrational quite a bit of the time, and I know it frustrates others looking in on that picture. I happen to be a time of day customer for PGE, so yesterday is Sunday. I did some things around the house that are big electricity users. Because it's Sunday, it's cheap. I can opt in any of the green pricing power programs anytime I want. I don't know how much easier it could be if I want to, quote, push the market. But aside from that, I don't think I really share the notion that some outside agent should push the market. The market reflects the dynamic interactions of buyers and sellers and supply and demand, and I think it moves on its own. Outside actors who want to push it, mostly what they really want is a slush fund to pay for some things that they couldn't persuade people to do, so that now they're going to force them to do because it's, quote, in their best interest. If we had a longer time period, we could talk about all of the many programs over history that were done in our best interest that proved to be a big mistake. So, and then there's no recourse because they were forced on us coercively. So I think utilities and utility customers already have very high incentives to do the types of things that we want. And I think we should let those processes work out. And we already have a safety net for low-income folks for the pure purchase of power through another charge.
So, Mr. Chair, I could go all day on other great things that have happened through collective, but obviously you don't want to turn this into a debate over every program that's been started and the many successes that are out there. So, Julie or Michael, do you buy into, I guess, Commissioner Byers' first two slides, which seemed to me to make relative sense, that we're going to pay one way or the other. Conservation, we're going to have to pay for that. It's going to come out of this slush fund. I don't know if it's a slush fund. I don't know if I agree with that. It's going to come out of this fund. Or we're just going to... We're going to have to generate it. And if you do agree with that, then perhaps you could get more consensus on, okay, well, let's just have a good discussion of which it's going to be, and we'll either pay for the generation or we'll pay for the conservation.
Well, I think we can have a debate about the relative costs of the resource options and conservation. Certainly, as you move up the down the timeline, and conservation opportunities become more expensive, there's a lot of discussion about the lifetime value of conservation measures, about their effectiveness, whether they provide energy savings or capacity savings. It's not necessarily a real straightforward reduce it to an average megawatt hour comparison. But also, I think, you know, it's a question of whether we're actually seeing any resources being deferred because of the conservation measures that are being taken. You know, utilities are highly motivated to build generation, to put plant in the ground. That's frankly how they make money. So I think there needs to be a conservation program. I think the 3% solved the issue that was identified in terms of the bust or boom cycle. 3% is a reasonable amount of money. It's increasing over time. We think it's been in place for a relatively short time. We're continuing to evaluate it. We think you should as well, and we can revisit it after we have a little more data.
Real quickly, and then we're going to move on here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to follow up on Senator Deckert's comments, because I think they're important. First of all, when you look at how the trust makes its funding decisions, it's not always the biggest bang for the buck. They have, because they're a self-appointing board, they have sort of this feeling that they need to be balanced. So, for example, they put and I'm guessing at these numbers, I think it was like around $300,000 into a solar program that was very expensive for the amount of conservation that it provided, whereas they could have invested that money into another type of program that provided a much bigger bang for the buck in terms of conservation and taking power off the grid. So, I think it kind of comes back to watching the trust grow. It's a very young organization. And, Mr. Chair, for the record, I submitted Myron Burr's testimony for him. He's from Siltronic.
Thank you.
And I apologize.
I was wondering where that came from, but thank you for submitting that. Okay, thank you very much. Our last person we have set to testify on our sheet is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm going to ask Jeff to come up, and then Senator Walker, who has been diligently going over her historical notes as well as making new ones, to conclude today's testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm here representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We are a private, independent, not-for-profit organization, but we are named in state law as the representative of residential ratepayers of utilities. I'm here today to the bill to encourage further discussion along these lines. I think that the comments of the panel before me raise a lot of interesting points. And I think that, you know, despite the claim that there was, you know, originally a 10-year sunset, is true, but that we might have some pointed and I think informative and enlightening discussion on whether or not it's too early to talk about extending that sunset. We live in a very different world, certainly than we did in 1999 when our original legislation of Senate Bill 1149 was passed. We live in a different world even than 2002 when the public purpose charge came into effect and started doing energy efficiency and renewables in the field. What we do know now is that we have a mechanism in place that in 2006, I believe, saved nearly 40 megawatts of power. More than twice has ever been saved in the state of Oregon before. That is a model that's working. While I would be happy to talk in further depth with Julie Brandis's contention about where we could save more and where efficiency dollars are better spent. The fact of the matter is that in the legislation that created the public purpose charge, there was money set aside for renewable investment and there was money set aside for conservation, and the two don't mix. And so to say that $300,000 in a solar or any sort of renewable investment could have been switched over to conservation, I'm not sure, it sort of misses that separation. And I think we need to be very clear on and careful about the terminology that we use, and we can't mix apples and oranges. I think, too, that there was a balance alluded to, and I don't think it's a balance between renewables and conservation because that balance is sort of struck in the law. But what there is a balance is between customer groups, and this money is collected across customer groups, residential, commercial, and industrial. And the Energy Trust is pretty careful in making sure that there is a balance struck in terms of where the investments are made and what class of customers is benefited from those investments. It's not a dollar for dollar, dollar in, dollar out kind of balance, but it's an overall balance. And right now I'm here to tell you that until recent months, the residential customers have actually come out on the short end of that stick. There has been more money being paid, or we have gotten out less dollars than we have actually put in. Am I here to complain about that? No. That is That is an issue that the Energy Trust has looked at, has gotten very big bang for the buck on several fairly large projects. A lot of them have been some low-hanging industrial fruit, frankly, and it was very appropriate for them to take advantage of the opportunity that that they had presented to them. And in some cases, they were once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, A, to save money, but also to save jobs and save sort of economic base in communities around the state. That goes to show, too, that the mechanism that we have is very market-based. The Energy Trust changes its investment or changes its incentives. Its goal is to try and find a tipping point between investments that will be made without its help and investments that wouldn't be made without that support. So they are continually adjusting incentives. And some people, in terms of the weatherization and energy efficiency industries, tend not to like that. They would like to see incentives stay in place and stay in place for 3, 4, 5 years at a time. But the changing nature of the market doesn't allow that. And so I think that we do have a very quick, very responsive mechanism in the Energy Trust. And right now, what we have to compare it to are 30 years of utility management of these programs. And frankly, speaking for the Citizens Utility Board, we would not go back to those days. One final thing, just on the overall purpose of doing conservation and renewable investments this way. As utility customers, we are investing in a system. We are investing in a grid. And so every time a utility makes a decision to invest in a plant, to upgrade a plant, every time that there is a conservation investment that's made, we are benefiting the system. We are benefiting the grid. We are benefiting the entire utility that all customers, residential, commercial, and industrial, benefit from. To say that we have to do that sort of on a nickel and dime and piecemeal basis is sort of underscoring, I think, a completely different system than the one we have operating today. And I think that's very important to understand. In the utility and energy field, we try and take as holistic a view and a holistic approach as we can in the planning. And so those investments are made, with an attempt to understand how each investment sort of will impact the one before it and the one next. And so I think that is just a point I wanted to make in terms of where this fits in the overall energy field. And with that, I'd be happy to just conclude by saying that we are looking forward to more discussion around these very important issues through this bill, through Senate Bill 87, which has been referenced earlier in this hearing. And also, it's very important to us to figure out how these issues also connect with other very key policy debates that are going on in terms of the renewable energy standard and other energy efficiency measures and renewable energy investments that we're looking at in terms of policy questions now. If anybody has any questions at this time, though, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Bissonnette? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Walker, I'll ask you for any concluding comments you want to make there, since you have been sitting throughout the entire hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I missed my entire judiciary hearing today, but I thought it was important that I listen to what folks were saying about the bill. I do want to thank Ms. Brandis, because it was her article in the AOI Leading Issues magazine of 9/19/06 that pointed out that the PUC had the authority to increase the public purpose charge without legislative approval on customers except large industrial customers. And I didn't know that. and neither did Dexter Johnson when I asked him to fix that problem. He said, no, they can do that. And I said, no, they can't. And he found out Ms. Brandis was correct. So I have been going through the notes from the hearings. Probably the most instructive was from May 5, 1999 in the House Committee on Commerce. And they raise a number of the issues that you've talked about today, that the 3% public purpose charge is really what has already been implicit in rates today, but as Commissioner Beyer pointed out, it was not done in a consistent and fair manner, and utilities were doing it or not doing it. And so this really puts it at the level that the public purpose charge put it at a level that we could do what we need to do for energy conservation. The question was asked of the commissioner at the time, Ron Ekus, whether after 10 years the 3% is there, that if a 10-year timeline for this 3% public purpose charge is there because it seemed to be a fair trade-off, or if it was how long we anticipate it will take to get equilibrium in the market. That was a question by then-Representative Al King. And Ron Ekus commented that he thought the comments would lean more toward the latter, but that it was a trade-off. And he felt that there are long-term benefits, that these are things that have long-term benefits but have short-term impact on price. And he actually foresaw a day that you might even not need the public purpose charge anymore, but that wasn't really what we were asking at that time, nor am I asking that today. The other concern, Mr. Chair, that's been raised today, I think Senator George brought it up, is whether Chairman Bill Witt, who was chair at the time, asked if there was concern that this bill granted too much authority to the PUC. Mr. Ekus responded generally, no. And he said, the only thing that is different from what we would do now or expect or hope to do is the low-income assistance program, which, as was pointed out, those are two separate programs that were added to Senate Bill 1149. So most of what they did in Senate Bill 1149 was what they would expect to be in there, and it is consistent with what the PUC already does. And the reason they don't want the legislature to have any more of that authority, Mr. Chair, is because it's too much minutia for the legislature to get involved in. And so it's much more appropriate to leave that those kinds of details to the PUC while we deal with the more general and broad policy, which I submit to you is what we're talking about here today. You do have the dash one and the dash two, and the dash one cleans up the language and makes the bill what I wanted it to be. And the dash two adds the commission's Senate Bill 87 to the discussion, which addresses some of the things that Senator Montes Anderson talked about. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for entertaining this hearing today. And I hope this will not be the end of the discussion.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Do you mind?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, the question has come up. Obviously, I was a little surprised at the amount of money that's in this pot. And I can't, from the testimony, I'm not sure if it's $67 million. I think $67 million per year. It could be biennium, but I think that works out to about $135 million per biennium, which is the size of a good state agency. And I'm just wondering this, if the Energy Trust has this kind of dollars in it, would you have any opposition to amendments to your bill that would bring this energy trust into something that the state legislature has more oversight? Because we're talking about a huge amount of money with $135 million, and I would sure feel more comfortable if we had a little more input on that. If elected officials someplace had more input on that, would that be an amendment that you'd be opposed to?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I'm not certain of that. And let me explain, too, that I wrote that $67 million number down, but I didn't write whether it was an annual number or a biennium. I just wrote it down as $67 million, $50 million of which goes to the Energy Trust. I think the trust does a tremendous job, and I really, really am not interested in mucking with that, simply because they do tremendous work. I served on the Western Governors Association Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee for 18 months, where we addressed renewable energy in the Northwest and actually all the Western states. And we had meetings all over the country, and everywhere I went, someone always made the comment to me when they found out I was from Oregon that we've got a really great thing with the Energy Trust, whether it's a self-appointed board, and that's a big deal.
feel, you know, we can talk about those things, but I sure wouldn't want to take away what's a really good thing for Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Juan. Well, okay, if the energy, so thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to ask this very short. I'm just trying to get up.
I'm actually, I'm trying to get them to wait around so you can vote on Senate Bill 605 before I lose a quorum.
Our customer owns in this. you're right on about the energy trust. Our customer owned utilities included EWEB and other.
Well, one of the pieces of testimony, Mr. Chair and Senator Deckert, that I read here was that in the bill, the word residential was not just meant to be residential customers. It included all classes of customers, including commercial customers. So that was the intent of Senate Bill 1149. Whether it's how it ended up, I can't tell you.
Mr. O'Connor, you want to clarify that?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. Couple quick points. As Michael early pointed out, the 3% public purpose charge was part of a quid pro quo for going to direct access, which was what folks wanted to do with 1149. They were absolutely linked together. And so the way it was done was that for the consumer-owned utilities, if we went to direct access, then we had to begin collecting the 3% public purpose charge. It was structured a little differently, but that's the requirement. It's that linkage that was in the original 1149, and yes, I guess, I don't know whether I was the varsity team, but I was part of that all the way through, and that was the absolute part of the linkage. And I guess I would point out that I think the amendments unintentionally, the dash ones, delete the whole section for consumer-owned utilities, which would take that whole section out, which is not something that we were asking to do. So we need to look at that. But the other thing I would point out in response to Senator Moniz Anderson's question, consumer-owned utilities through our Bonneville contracts are required to operate and provide conservation programs. If we do not, we are penalized in our contracts. We either spend the money to do the programs or we're penalized by Bonneville. In addition to that, through our Bonneville rates, we also pay for, there's low-income weatherization funds and so on that come in from Bonneville. There are utilities that put in additional amounts than that beyond that. Also, in the new Bonneville contracts that we will be signing on 2011, a very important difference is going to happen. Up till this time, Bonneville has melded our rates for the existing resources, the vintage resources that are there, and new resources. They've been a melded rate that we paid. The new contracts will separate that, and they will say that there'll be a Tier 1 rate, which is the existing resources. At that point, then, Bonneville does not build resources for us anymore. We will be at the market for new resources. So in the new contract, in addition to those requirements, there's an extremely powerful incentive for conservation because of the need to try to keep as much of your load in Tier 1.
Okay. Thank you. What we're going to do with this bill is I'm going to have some conversation with Senator Walker, and we will keep this alive with our other issues, and we'll be revisiting these as we move forward and see what we might do. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 418, and I would ask unanimous consent to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 605 for the purpose of asking Senator Deckert if he would like to vote on the chimney bill. Senator Deckert, how would you vote on Senate Bill 605?
On the chimney bill. I'll vote yes for chimneys.
Okay. Please record Senator Deckert as an aye vote on Senate Bill 605. Close the work session on Senate Bill 605, and we're adjourned.